In the heart of the Caribbean, a small island nation lived for three decades under the iron grip of one man. Mario Vargas Llosa's The Feast of the Goat isn't just another historical novel about dictatorship. It's a masterful psychological exploration of power, complicity, and trauma that continues to resonate with readers worldwide. Since its publication in 2000, this literary tour de force has been translated into 20 languages and adapted for both stage and screen. When Gabriel Garcia Marquez was asked about the most important Latin American novel of recent decades, he reportedly paused before reluctantly acknowledging his literary rival's achievement. Damn it, probably The Feast of the Goat. The book's unflinching examination of dictatorship has made it required reading in political science courses from Harvard to the Sorbonne, while its exploration of trauma has earned it a place in psychology curriculums. Through the story of Rafael Trujillo's Dominican Republic, Vargas Llosa invites us to confront uncomfortable truths about power, complicity, and the long shadow of historical trauma. After 35 years of self-imposed exile, Urania Cabral returns to Santo Domingo, the city once named Ciudad Trujillo after the dictator who dominated every aspect of Dominican life. Now a successful New York attorney, Urania walks through streets that seem both familiar and foreign, noting how the tropical scents and chaotic sounds trigger memories of her childhood. The colonial architecture of her old neighborhood Gascue remains largely unchanged, yet everything feels different through her adult eyes. Urania has come to confront her father, once the powerful senator Augustin Egghead Cabral, now reduced to a shell of himself, paralyzed by a stroke, unable to speak or care for himself. As she approaches her childhood home on Calle Cesar Nicolas Penson, she finds it deteriorated, peeling paint, an overgrown garden, the once magnificent flamboyant tree, now just a bare trunk with a few struggling branches. Only the mango tree remains vibrant, a living witness to the family's decline. When a nurse appears at the date, Urania identifies herself after a moment of emotional hesitation. This visit isn't a reconciliation, but a reckoning. For 35 years, she has refused all contact with her father, ignoring the family photos and letters that occasionally reached her in New York. Now she's returned not with forgiveness, but with questions that have haunted her since adolescence. Questions about betrayal, complicity, and the moral compromises made under Trujillo's regime. As she waits in her hotel room before visiting her father, Urania contemplates her transformation from a frightened 14-year-old Catholic schoolgirl to a successful but emotionally isolated professional woman. Despite her impressive career, she has never formed intimate relationships, never allowed herself vulnerability. The trauma of her past has built walls around her that no one has penetrated. Her return to Santo Domingo isn't about healing, but about finally speaking her truth to the man who betrayed her, even if he can no longer respond. At precisely 4 o'clock each morning, Rafael Leonidas Trujillo Molina awakens without an alarm clock. His body, disciplined through decades of military routine, operates with mechanical precision. Despite his 70 years and increasing physical ailments, including the humiliating incontinence that has begun to plague him, Trujillo adheres to his strict morning regimen of exercises, attributing his success to the discipline instilled in him by the U.S. Marines during the American occupation. As he performs his meticulous morning ablutions, Trujillo's thoughts reveal a man obsessed with control of his body, his appearance, and his nation. He applies powder to hide his dark skin tone, a reminder of the Haitian blacks who were his maternal ancestors, revealing the racial self-hatred that would later manifest in the massacre of thousands of Haitians. Every detail of his grooming ritual reflects his need for absolute perfection and dominance. While listening to morning radio broadcasts, Trujillo seethes at attacks from Catholic bishops who have turned against his regime. Despite Johnny Abe's suggestion to forcibly remove the American bishop, Trujillo calculates that the timing isn't right for direct action against the clergy. his thoughts drift to his disappointing sons, Romphus and Rodahams, playing polo in Paris and fucking French girls, while he fights what he considers the battle of his life against international pressure and domestic opposition. The portrait that emerges is of a man whose iron discipline and calculated cruelty have allowed him to maintain absolute power for three decades. Yet beneath the carefully maintained facade lies increasing vulnerability, physical decline, international isolation, and growing domestic resistance. Trujillo's inner monologue reveals not just a tyrant, but a human being whose monstrous actions stem from deep-seated insecurities and an insatiable need for control. His rage at perceived betrayals, his contempt for those he considers weak, including his own sons, and his determination to maintain his grip on power at any cost provide a chilling glimpse into the psychology of dictatorship. On a dark night in May 1961, four men sit in a parked car across from the Malecón, waiting for Trujillo's sky-blue Chevrolet to appear. Salvatore, Amadito, Antonio Imbert, and Antonio de la Maza have been planning this moment for months, the assassination of the man they once served loyally. Their tense conversation reveals the complex motivations that have brought them to this point of no return. Each conspirator has his own reasons for turning against the GOAT, as they call Trujillo. Antonio de la Maza seeks vengeance for his brother Tavito, who was murdered after becoming unwittingly involved in the kidnapping of Jesus de Galíndez, a Basque professor who had criticized the regime. Despite Antonio's warnings, Tavito's blind faith in Trujillo led to his death and posthumous humiliation when the regime forged a suicide note claiming he had killed an American pilot over homosexual advances. For Lieutenant Amadito Garcia Guerrero, the breaking point came when Trujillo personally forbade his marriage to Luisa Gil because her brother was associated with the June 14 opposition movement. This heartbreak was followed by a devastating test of loyalty that drove him to join the plot against the dictator he once served devotedly. Salvatore Estrella Sadala, known as Turk for his Lebanese heritage, finds moral justification for tyrannicide in his Catholic faith. He reveals that the papal nuncio himself showed him a passage from St. Thomas Aquinas stating that God looks with favor upon the physical elimination of the beast if a people is freed thereby. This divine sanction gives Salvador peace about the violent act they are planning. Antonio Imbert, once a faithful Trujillista, who even offered to burn Puerto Plata to demonstrate his loyalty, describes his gradual disillusionment with the regime. The murder of the Mirabal sisters in November 1960, three women whose only crime was opposing the dictatorship, was a turning point for many Dominicans, including Imbert, who speaks of Minerva Mirabal's intelligence and courage with tears in his eyes. As they wait in their ambush position, the conspirators reveal not just their reasons for turning against Trujillo, but also their fears about what will follow. They hope General Pupo Roman will lead a military uprising after Trujillo's death, but doubts linger about whether their plan will succeed or whether they're simply sacrificing themselves. Antonio de la Maza carries poison in his shoe to avoid capture and torture, determined not to be taken alive. The conspirators represent the moral awakening of a society that has lived too long under tyranny. Once loyal servants of the regime, they have come to recognize that eliminating Trujillo is necessary for their nation's redemption, even if it costs them their lives. Senator Augustin Egghead Cabral's downfall begins with a letter in the public forum of El Caribe newspaper in early 1961. This dreaded newspaper section, controlled by the National Palace, serves as a political barometer in Trujillo's Dominican Republic. When Cabral discovers a letter accusing him of irregularities during his time as Minister of Public Works and claiming he has been stripped of his Senate presidency, he maintains his composure while having breakfast with his daughter Urania, though he immediately recognizes the gravity of the situation. A call to the newspaper's editor confirms his worst fears. The letter came recommended, meaning it originated from Trujillo himself. Arriving at the Senate, Cabral finds the executive committee meeting canceled without his knowledge. Vice President Quintanilla confirms that all committees involving Cabral have been suspended until the status of the President of the Senate is regularized, on orders from Henry Chirinos, once considered a close friend of the family. The sudden fall from grace illustrates the precarious nature of power under Trujillo's regime. Even the highest officials could be destroyed on the dictator's whim, often without understanding what they had done to displease the chief. For Cabral, who had devoted his life to serving Trujillo faithfully, this rejection is devastating, not just professionally, but existentially. His identity and self-worth have been built entirely around his position in Trujillo's inner circle. In desperation, Cabral visits SIM headquarters and meets with Colonel Johnny Abes Garcia, who coldly suggests Cabral may have fallen from favor for attending a cocktail party at the American Charged Affairs home. Though Cabral explains he attended on Trujillo's orders, Abes remains unmoved, hinting at political differences regarding U.S. relations. Leaving dejected, Cabral wanders Ciudad Trujillo streets for hours, contemplating his precarious situation and worrying about his daughter Uranita's fate if he's imprisoned or killed. Finding a newspaper, he learns his friend Manuel Alfonso has returned from abroad, perhaps his key to redemption. This glimmer of hope leads to the fateful decision that will destroy his relationship with his daughter and haunt him for the rest of his life. Alfonso suggested Cabral offer his 14-year-old daughter Urania to Trujillo as a way to regain favor, framing this as a noble sacrifice rather than the monstrous betrayal it truly is. The episode reveals how totalitarianism corrupts not just political institutions, but the most intimate human relationships. A father's love for his daughter becomes subordinate to his desperate need to regain the dictator's favor. Cabral's moral collapse exemplifies how dictatorships don't merely oppress through violence, but by making people complicit in their own degradation and that of those they love. On the night of May 30, 1961, the conspirators' plan is finally set in motion. When Trujillo's sky blue Chevrolet appears on the highway to San Cristobal, the assassins pursue it, opening fire and shattering the windows. After a chaotic exchange of gunfire, they confirm Trujillo is dead. In the confusion afterward, Salvatore accidentally shoots Pedro Livio Sedeno, one of their own conspirators who had arrived late to the ambush. The assassination scene unfolds with cinematic intensity, capturing both the violence of the moment and its historical significance. After 31 years of absolute power, Trujillo's life ends in seconds on a dark highway. The dictator who controlled every aspect of Dominican life is suddenly reduced to a corpse in a car trunk. But the assassination is only the beginning of the story. The conspirators' plan called for General Jose René Pupo Roman to lead a military uprising immediately after Trujillo's death, arresting key regime figures and establishing a provisional government. When Roman fails to appear, the conspirators realize their plan may be unraveling. They separate, with the wounded Pedro Livio taken to the International Clinic rather than given the coup de grace they had agreed upon for wounded conspirators. This fateful decision leads to disaster when Colonel Johnny Abes Garcia, head of the SIM, arrives at the hospital with armed men. Despite his weakened state, Pedro Livio endures brutal interrogation, with Abes putting out lit cigarettes on his face and in his mouth. Through his pain, Pedro Livio reveals crucial details about the conspiracy, including the involvement of Antonio Imbert, Antonio de la Maza, General Pupo Roman, and even President Balaguer in a planned civilian-military junta. As Pedro Livio slips toward unconsciousness, he realizes with despair that despite killing Trujillo, the planned transition of power hasn't occurred. The revolution appears to have stalled. Left alone with Abes, Pedro Livio is tormented not by the threat of more cigarette burns, but by the realization that their sacrifice may have been in vain. The night of the assassination reveals both the courage of the conspirators and the fragility of their plan. Killing a dictator, they discover, is easier than dismantling the system of terror he has built. Without decisive action by their military allies, the assassination risks becoming merely another tragic episode in Dominican history rather than the liberation they had hoped for. Here's a sensitively rewritten version that preserves the core narrative and themes while using more appropriate language for audio. The Unforgivable Betrayal, Urania's Story. The novel reaches its emotional pinnacle when Urania finally shares with her aunt and cousins the reason behind her 35-year estrangement from her father. Following Senator Cabral's political downfall, his colleague Manuel Alfonso suggested an unconscionable solution, proposing that Cabral's 14-year-old daughter Urania attend a private gathering with Trujillo to help restore her father's position. Alfonso attempted to normalize this suggestion, claiming he would consider it an honor if his own daughter could gain the dictator's favor, comparing Trujillo to historical figures like Charlemagne, Napoleon, and Bolivar. When Senator Cabral receives an invitation for Urania to attend an event at Trujillo's estate alone, he presents it to his daughter as a diplomatic opportunity, while adding she has no obligation. The naive teenager, unaware of the implications, focuses only on superficial concerns like her attire and how she might help restore her father's standing. The subsequent events at Mahogany House prove deeply traumatic. Left alone with the 70-year-old dictator, the 14-year-old Urania experiences a profound violation of trust and dignity. The encounter leaves her with both physical and psychological wounds, which Sister Mary at Santo Domingo Academy later tends to with great care and discretion. This experience fundamentally altered Urania's life trajectory. Despite becoming a successful attorney in New York, she confides to her family that the trauma has prevented her from forming intimate relationships throughout her adult life. Her emotional development remains suspended at the moment of that profound betrayal, when her father chose political expediency over protecting his child. Her family receives this revelation with shock, particularly her Aunt Adelina, who attempts to contextualize it as a product of different times and suggests forgiveness. Urania's powerful response, that the psychological impact of that era still permeates Dominican society, speaks to dictatorship's enduring legacy, how its moral corruption infiltrates family bonds and continues to affect relationships long after the regime's fall. Through Urania's narrative, the novel examines how political oppression transforms into personal trauma, how authoritarian control corrupts not just governmental institutions, but also the most fundamental family relationships. Her personal experience symbolizes the collective trauma of a nation, where moral boundaries were systematically undermined during 3 decades of authoritarian rule. Following Trujillo's assassination, a complex power struggle unfolds that will determine the Dominican Republic's future. President Joaquin Balaguer, long considered Trujillo's puppet, reveals himself as a masterful political strategist who will ultimately outlast the Trujillo family and transform himself from dictatorship's servant to democracy's architect. When news of Trujillo's death reaches the National Palace, Balaguer immediately moves to secure his position by contacting military commanders nationwide. When diplomats arrive concerned about the kidnapped American Bishop Riley, Balaguer skillfully intervenes to save the bishop's life, convincing General Virgilio Garcia Trujillo to rescue him from detention, a move that earns him crucial goodwill from the United States. Meanwhile, Ramphis Trujillo returns to the Dominican Republic determined to avenge his father's death. The conspirators who killed Trujillo are hunted down one by one. Antonio de la Maza and Juan Tomas Diaz die in a shootout near Independencia Park. Lieutenant Amadito Garcia is killed at his aunt's home after refusing to surrender, his body tied to a Volkswagen roof and paraded through the city. Salvador Turk, Estrella Sadala, and other captured conspirators endure months of imprisonment and torture. In a particularly cruel psychological torture, Salvador is shown a newspaper containing his own father's public letter denouncing him as a traitor and thanking Romphis for financial support. Despite being transferred to better conditions at La Victoria prison as international pressure mounts, Salvador and five others are eventually taken to a remote cliff where they are executed after witnessing the murder of their young guards. General José René Pupo Ramón, whose failure to act after the assassination doomed the conspiracy, suffers perhaps the most horrific fate. At El Nueve Torture Facility, Romphis Trujillo personally oversees his torture, which includes electric shocks, eye sewing, castration, and starvation. After 4 months of unimaginable suffering, Romphis finally ends Roman's life when doctors say he can't survive any longer. Only two conspirators survive, Antonio Imbert and Luis Amiama. Imbert finds refuge with an Italian diplomatic couple who shelter him for 6 months, while the regime offers increasing rewards for his capture. From their apartment, he watches as other conspirators are hunted down and killed while following news of the country's political evolution. Throughout this bloody period, Balaguer performs a delicate balancing act, allowing Romphis his vengeance while gradually implementing democratic reforms that win American support. He exiles Colonel Abes Garcia to Japan with a diplomatic post, appoints the morally repugnant but politically useful Senator Chirinas as parliamentary leader, and begins dismantling Trujillo's legacy by renaming cities and removing monuments. When Trujillo's brothers Peyton and Blackie return from abroad threatening a military coup, Balaguer learns from the American consul that President Kennedy has dispatched warships with 2,000 Marines to intervene if necessary. Using this information, Balaguer convinces the brothers to leave the country in exchange for millions in cash payments. With the Trujillo's departure, Balaguer declares a general political amnesty and dissolves the Dominican Party. In a final ironic twist, he welcomes the surviving conspirators, Imbert and Amiama, to the National Palace with honors, the same men who killed the dictator he had served for decades. The aftermath of the assassination reveals how power transitions in the wake of dictatorship, not through clean breaks, but through complex negotiations where yesterday's servants of tyranny become today's champions of democracy. Balaguer's survival and transformation represent the ambiguous nature of political change, where continuity often matters as much as rupture. As Urania prepares to return to New York after her confrontation with her invalid father, she questions whether sharing her story has made any difference to her pain. Her family begs her not to disappear for another 35 years, and though she promises to stay in touch, she's uncertain whether she'll maintain the connection once she returns to her carefully constructed life in America. Her aunt Adelina, distressed by Urania's revelations, suggests Augustine might not have known what would happen, that perhaps Alfonso deceived him. This attempt to mitigate his culpability only underscores the moral compromises that permeated Dominican society under Trujillo, the willingness to look away, to make excuses, to rationalize complicity with evil. On her way back to the hotel, Urania recalls the violent death of Johnny Abes Garcia in Haiti, killed with his entire family by Duvalier's men, and wonders if such a fate would have satisfied her desire for vengeance against her father. At the hotel, she rebuffs a drunken tourist's advances and decides that if her young niece Marianita writes to her as promised, she will answer all her letters, a small opening toward connection after decades of isolation. This tentative possibility of relationship represents the novel's ambiguous conclusion about healing from historical trauma. There are no easy resolutions, no simple reconciliations. The wounds inflicted by dictatorship, both personal and collective, cannot be quickly healed. They require acknowledgement, truth-telling, and the patient work of rebuilding trust. Through Urania's story and the larger historical narrative, Vargas Llosa explores how dictatorships damage the human soul. The novel suggests that the most insidious legacy of tyranny is not just the physical violence it inflicts, but its corruption of human relationships. the way it turns fathers against daughters, friends against friends, citizens against each other. This moral damage outlasts the dictator himself, continuing to shape lives and societies long after the regime has fallen. Yet in Urania's willingness to tell her story, in the conspirator's courage to act against tyranny despite the cost, in the small acts of resistance and integrity that punctuate the narrative, the novel also offers glimpses of human resilience. It suggests that while dictatorships reveal humanity's capacity for cruelty and complicity, they also occasionally reveal our capacity for courage and moral awakening. The Feast of the Goat, the dictator's feast of power, eventually ends, but its aftermath requires the difficult work of confronting truth, acknowledging complicity, and rebuilding the moral foundations of society. This work, the novel suggests, is never fully complete, but continues across generations as societies struggle to understand their past and create a more just future.